What if I told you that the true masters of the global economy actually don't care at all about the stock market? Like, while we're all watching the green and red tickers flash on the news, the real power on Wall Street is operating this hidden, multi-trillion-dollar control system totally out of public view.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal illusion, honestly. We spend all our time arguing about, famous CEOs and household brand names, and we completely miss the invisible plumbing that actually dictates where the money is allowed to go in the first place.
Right, and that is exactly what we're exposing today. So we are taking a deep dive into this incredibly detailed elite financial strategy report. It's from June 2026, titled The Wall Street Power Map 2026, authored by the American newspaper and American TV.
And I mean, whether you're prepping for a high-stakes financial meeting or just trying to decode the modern economy, or if you're just, insanely curious about who actually pulls the strings, this deep dive is really your ultimate shortcut.
Exactly. So what makes this report so critical?
Well, it's the core thesis. It completely discards those traditional league tables you always see. The rankings of who did the most mergers or who has the wealthiest clients. Instead, it argues that true power is built around five very specific, very scarce capabilities.
And those are dollar liquidity, balance sheet risk, institutional allocation, market info, and policy access.
Right, exactly. Those five.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the report builds a literal pyramid of power out of those capabilities. And the foundation of that pyramid, the bedrock that everything else rests on, it isn't even money.
No, not at all. Because before a single dollar can be allocated or leveraged or hedged, the players need to know what they're actually looking at. So the foundation is the operating system itself. It's data, rules, and information.
Yeah, the report calls this the information and rules axis. And I mean, the scale is just staggering. We're talking about companies like S&P Global, which pulled in $15.3 billion in revenue in 2025
Oh,
alone.
yeah. And you've got Moody's, MSCI, Bloomberg, the London Stock Exchange Group.
It's kind of like they're the map makers and toll booth operators of the financial world. Like, they aren't digging for gold themselves, but they decide exactly where the map says the gold is and who is legally allowed to dig for it.
That's a great way to put it. And what's fascinating here is that whoever owns the screen or the risk model or the index rules, they essentially shape how capital views reality before it ever makes a decision to buy or sell.
But how does that translate to actual, like, physical capital power? How does making the map control the money?
Well, take BlackRock's Aladdin platform. On the surface, it's just a risk analytics software system, but underneath, it has basically become the operating system for global investors. It tells trillions of dollars how much risk they are holding.
Wow.
Or consider index inclusion. The report highlights a Reuters stat from June 2026 showing that $5.79 trillion currently tracks MSCI's benchmarks.
Wait, let me make sure I understand the mechanism there. Are you saying almost $6 trillion is just mechanically following a list published by MSCI?
That is the mechanism precisely. I mean, if MSCI decides to change the rules of their index, or they decide to include a new company, that $5.79 trillion has to adjust its portfolio.
So it just forces automatic buying.
Exactly. The human agency is completely removed from the equation. The index provider isn't risking a single dime of their own capital, but their rule book dictates where trillions of dollars must physically flow.
That is wild. It's literally automated power.
Yeah.
And I guess the same goes for credit ratings from S&P or Moody's, right? Because they dictate whether a pension fund is even legally allowed to buy a bond.
Right. They completely control the grammar of the market.
Okay, but knowing the rules of the data map isn't enough if you don't control the actual currency those trades run on. Which brings us to the ground zero of this power map. And well, here is where I kind of have to push back on the report a little bit.
Oh, how so?
Because if you ask anyone on the street, honestly, if you asked me before I read this what the center of the financial universe is, I would say the global stock market, the equities.
And you would be looking at the wrong part of the ocean, honestly.
But why? I mean, equities are what everyone watches and it's what all our retirement accounts are tied to.
Sure, but if we connect this to the bigger picture, stocks are really just the volatile surface of the water. The actual ocean floor, the deepest node of systemic power, is the U.S. Treasury and dollar liquidity complex.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, U.S. Treasury securities are the benchmark risk-free asset for the entire world. They are the core collateral for the repo market.
Let's slow down and define that for a second for everyone listening. The repo market.
Right, yes, the repurchase agreement market. It is essentially how the world's biggest banks fund themselves overnight. They trade treasuries for cash to keep their lights on and their books balanced.
Got it.
So treasuries are the anchor for all dollar funding globally, and the institutions that sit at this node are the primary dealers.
You're talking about the universal banks here, like JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, Citigroup.
Correct. The New York Fed relies on these primary dealers not just to trade government bonds, but to act as official counterparties. They're the designated players expected to bid in treasury auctions and, provide market liquidity when things get rough.
Okay, but the report points out that this specific market, the treasury market, is going through a massive structural shift right now in 2026. Like the tectonic plates are shifting beneath these primary dealers because the SEC is rolling out new treasury clearing rules.
Oh, it's a huge deal. This is a crucial pivot point in financial history. The compliance deadlines are fast approaching. You have December 31st, 2026 for eligible cash treasury transactions and June 30th, 2027 for eligible repo transactions.
So I want to translate that for anyone listening who doesn't work on a Wall Street trading desk. What does this SEC rule change actually do to a bank's daily routine?
Well, historically, a lot of these massive treasury trades happen bilaterally, just two banks making an agreement between themselves in the shadows, basically.
Right.
What the SEC is doing is forcing these trades out of the shadows and into central clearinghouses.
It's like moving from a handshake deal in a back alley to a heavily guarded casino floor. Like the house now holds everyone's chips, which gives the house all the power.
That is a perfect analogy. Yeah, when you force central clearing, power moves toward the clearinghouses themselves, institutions like FICC and DTCC.
And those stand for the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation
Yeah.
and the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation,
Right.
right? The massive utilities that actually process and settle the trades.
Yes, exactly. The power shifts to them and to the platforms that control the collateral and the margin requirements. It's no longer just about which primary dealer has the most aggressive traders.
It's about operations.
Exactly. It's about who can operationally connect their clients to central clearing and manage the settlement without failing.
And we're seeing the U.S. Treasury itself actively stepping in to manage this transition, aren't we? Like the report notes, the Treasury's May 2026 refunding statement, where they announced they were buying back up to $38 billion in off-the-run securities. Just to clarify, off-the-run basically means older government bonds that aren't traded as heavily anymore, right? So they're buying them back just to keep the plumbing from getting clogged.
Exactly. It just highlights how the government and Wall Street are totally intertwined at this level. The primary dealers have to build the infrastructure to survive within the boundary conditions set by the state.
And the state needs the primary dealers to keep the system functioning.
Precisely. I mean, whether it's the SEC, the CFTC, or U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent making remarks linking trade policy and national security, that regulatory posture is the weather system these banks have to navigate.
Right. And just to be clear to you listening, we're not endorsing any of the politics behind those policies, just impartially noting that it's the structural reality Wall Street has to deal with. And navigating that storm requires a massive balance sheet because in a crisis, nobody cares how famous your bank's logo is.
No, not at all.
They only care if your bank can finance treasuries, clear transactions, and absorb forced selling without going bankrupt.
Precisely. The ability to absorb risk is the real currency.
Which brings us to the next level of the pyramid. Because once the data map is drawn and the treasury collateral is functioning, who actually holds all the chips?
Yeah.
You know, if you've got money in a standard retirement account, you might think you're just a passenger in this system. But you are the capital they are fighting over.
Yeah, we are talking about the institutional allocators, and the numbers are so large they almost lose their meaning.
Yeah, it's hard to even wrap your head around.
The scale is very difficult for the human brain to conceptualize. On the public, passive side alone, BlackRock reported $12.82 trillion in assets under management in Q1 2026.
Wow.
And Vanguard is overseeing roughly $12 trillion globally. State Street has $5.6 trillion in AUM and over $54 trillion in assets under custody and administration.
But the report is clear that they don't wield this power the way a traditional Wall Street titan used to, right? They aren't typically underwriting corporate mergers or taking wild bets on their own balance sheets. So how do these passive giants actually exercise their power over the economy?
Their power is entirely structural because they control the flow of capital through ETFs, index funds, and retirement products. They effectively own a slice of every public company in the world.
Right.
And they exercise immense power through corporate stewardship. meaning their proxy votes can dictate who sits on a corporate board and what initiatives a company pursues. Furthermore, they engage in securities lending.
Wait, meaning they lend the shares they hold to other traders?
Yes. So if a hedge fund wants to bet against a stock, like to short it, they have to borrow the shares from somewhere. The massive passive allocators are the ones lending those shares, which means they literally control the friction and the cost of getting against a company.
So they're basically the permanent owners of the economy.
Exactly.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting, though, because the report directly contrasts those passive public allocators with the explosive rise of the private market challenger.
Oh, yeah.
You have firms like Blackstone sitting at $1.304 trillion, Apollo at $1.03 trillion, plus heavyweights like KKR and Ares. The report explicitly states that private credit has moved from being an alternative investment to becoming core financing infrastructure.
Yes, that's a huge distinction.
So are firms like Apollo and Ares essentially just acting as shadow banks now?
Well, I would hesitate to use the term shadow bank, actually, because it implies something peripheral or unregulated. You're hitting on the most important structural shift of 2026. These alternative managers are not in the shadows. They're competing directly with traditional banks in plain sight, and they are winning.
Really? How does that actually work mechanically? Like, why is an alternative manager beating a massive traditional bank at their own game?
Because traditional banks are heavily constrained by global capital rules. They take deposits from everyday citizens, right? So regulators force them to hold massive reserves to protect the system from collapsing.
Makes sense.
But alternative managers do not take everyday deposits in the same way. They raise pools of permanent capital from pensions and sovereign wealth funds that is locked up for years. Because they don't have those strict deposit-taking constraints, these private firms are aggressively taking over origination.
Meaning they are the ones writing the actual loans for massive projects.
Exactly. Direct lending to corporations, asset-based finance, infrastructure funding. I mean, let's look at the AI infrastructure boom as the perfect example. Morgan Stanley projected that global AI-related debt issuance will exceed $570 billion in 2026 alone.
Over half a trillion dollars just to build out the physical architecture of AI.
Yes. Hyperscalers, server farms, semiconductors, and the massive power utilities required to keep them all from melting down. You cannot just swipe a corporate credit card for that.
Right, obviously not.
It requires highly complex project finance and structured credit, and a traditional bank might really struggle to hold a highly complex, illiquid 10-year data center loan on its balance sheet because of those regulatory constraints we talked about.
But the private credit managers can.
Exactly. They have the exact type of locked-up capital to fund it. They are perfectly merging investment banking, private credit, and utility financing.
Okay, so we have the data providers setting the rules, the primary dealers managing the treasury collateral, the massive passive allocators owning the public markets, and the private credit giants financing the new infrastructure. But who is taking the biggest, most aggressive swings with that capital? Who sits at the very top of the risk pyramid?
The alpha generators, the hedge funds and the market makers.
Yeah, the report notes that the hedge fund industry passed the $5 trillion milestone in Q1 2026, according to HFR data. And we aren't talking about a bunch of lone wolf traders screaming into telephones anymore, are we?
No, not at all. Power is concentrated in massive multi-strategy platforms like Citadel, Millennium, and Point72. They operate almost like capital allocation institutions themselves, hiring dozens of portfolio managers, setting strict risk limits, and dominating the talent market.
Right. And on the other side, you have the pure quant and market-making firms like Jane Street and Susquehanna just extracting billions from ETF arbitrage and high-speed information advantages.
Yeah, they are the ultimate aggregators of talent, technology, and speed.
So what does this all mean for their actual independence? Because if you look at the report's hidden leverage map, it intimately links the power of these $5 trillion hedge funds to bank prime brokerage.
It does.
If Citadel or Millennium are so powerful and sophisticated, why aren't they considered totally independent operators?
Because a hedge fund's power isn't merely its trading talent or its proprietary algorithms. Its power is its financing. To generate those outsized returns, hedge funds use massive amounts of leverage.
Right. They borrow money to amplify their trades.
And they borrow that money from the prime brokerage desks of the big banks like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, or JP Morgan.
So the talent is the high performance engine, but the prime broker owns the gas station.
Precisely. And the gas station sets the rules. The report notes that Goldman Sachs Prime Services reported gross leverage in its book hitting record highs by the end of 2025. And Reuters noted in June 2026 that hedge fund leverage hit a five-year high.
So the banks are supplying just unprecedented amounts of rocket fuel. But how does that give the bank control over the hedge fund?
Through the terms of the loan, the prime broker sets the margin terms. They decide the haircuts on collateral.
Wait, explain a haircut in this context, because I assume we aren't talking about going to the barber.
No, definitely not. So if a hedge fund pledges a $100 bond as collateral for a loan, the prime broker might say, well, we view this bond as risky, so we will only lend you $90 against it.
Okay.
That $10 difference is the haircut. The broker also controls stock loan availability. Ultimately, the prime broker actually dictates which hedge fund strategies can mathematically survive. Yeah, if a prime broker suddenly decides a specific quantitative strategy is too risky and they increase the margin requirement or increase the haircut, the hedge fund might be forced to liquidate its position instantly, no matter how brilliant their algorithm is.
It is a stunning, deeply interconnected ecosystem. Every layer completely relies on the layer beneath it. But let's bring this down to earth for a minute. If I am an executive listening to this, or a founder, it is easy to get totally overwhelmed by these astronomical numbers. How does an actual business apply this power map in the real world to get what they want?
Right, and the report provides a really specific playbook for that, using Korean companies, investors, and startups as a brilliant case study for practical application.
Yeah, the playbook says that if a startup is looking for U.S. growth capital right now, they shouldn't just walk into a boardroom and pitch how great their technology is.
Because great technology alone doesn't solve the investor's structural problem. Mm-hmm. The playbook advises that founders must sell U.S. market access and governance readiness.
They need to prove they understand the NASDAQ or NYSE ecosystem.
Exactly. They need to show they have the right legal architecture in place, employing top-tier firms like Sullivan and Cromwell or Davis Polk to ensure they are legally and structurally ready for an eventual exit.
And what if a massive company wants to finance one of those AI data centers we were just talking about?
Yeah.
I assume they don't just call up their local commercial bank branch.
No, definitely not. Because as we discussed, a single commercial bank doesn't hold the right kind of capital for that specific risk profile. The playbook says you have to assemble a bespoke financial syndicate.
Right.
You blend private credit from an Apollo or a Blackstone. You bring in infrastructure equity, and you must involve the power utilities and the rating agencies from the very beginning. You're actively navigating multiple layers of the power pyramid simultaneously.
And for the everyday investors or market analysts trying to figure out where the economy is going,
mm-hmm.
The report is wonderfully blunt on this. It basically says, if you want to know the future of the market, you need to track ETF flows, treasury auctions, repo market stress, and prime broker leverage. That is the actual plumbing.
It requires a complete shift in perspective. The report suggests that organizations need to stop relying on outdated league table rankings. Instead, they must build what it calls decision intelligence dashboards.
Meaning systems that directly link policy changes, dollar liquidity, credit conditions, and institutional flows.
Exactly. You cannot just look at the players anymore. You have to map the network.
So just to recap the journey we've taken today, we started at the bedrock. The data, the rules, the index providers like MSCI and S&P that mathematically forced trillions of dollars into the market. We moved up into the sovereign core, the U.S. Treasury market, where primary dealers and clearinghouses like DTCC manage the vital dollar liquidity that keeps the entire global system funded overnight.
Right. And from there, we examined the allocators, the structural power of the massive passive funds, you know, BlackRock, Vanguard, and the aggressive rise of private credit markets like Blackstone and Apollo, who are actively originating debt and replacing traditional banks in core financing for things like AI infrastructure.
And finally, we reached the apex predators, the hedge funds like Citadel and Millennium, whose massive multi-strategy power is intimately totally tied to the leverage and margin rules provided by bank prime brokers.
It is an incredibly delicate balance.
It really is. But before we wrap up, there is one detail in this report that I just can't stop thinking about. It is a very subtle warning buried in the analysis of that private credit boom we discussed.
Yes, the liquidity mismatch. This raises an important question that the market is largely ignoring right now.
Yeah, because the report specifically mentions that private credit retail products, financial vehicles like interval funds and business development companies, or BDCs, are increasingly being sold to everyday retail investors.
And these specific products promise liquidity. They promise the investor that they can get their money out relatively easily on a regular basis.
But if you look at the underlying assets those funds are actually holding, there are things like complex, highly illiquid, AI data center debt, that is legally locked up for years.
Right, which means the fund is promising liquid cash while holding illiquid concrete and servers.
Exactly.
So here's the thought I want you to ponder. What happens to the global financial system when the next major market shock hits and thousands of retail investors simultaneously ask for their money back from these private credit funds, only to discover that the liquid cash they thought they had is actually locked up in an illiquid 10-year server farm loan?
Wow.
It will be the ultimate test of whether private credit can actually remain a mainstream allocation during severe systemic stress, or if the system completely fractures.
Definitely something to keep you up at night the next time you look at a map of the world. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the consensus. Keep looking beneath the surface of those financial headlines, and we will see you next time.